He wore a dark cutaway suit. He was about 5'7", foreign-looking, dark hair, and he gave the appearance of being shabby genteel, and then he wore that ghastly deerstalker hat. He was seen only twice, and that was with the actual victim just before it must have happened. These killings occurred within minutes of cops coming and going with people, and there suddenly there's a body that's been eviscerated, and there's no noise, nothing, no clue. Well, there's lots of clues, but there's no clue that could ever be followed. And that is what then held all of London for all of October and November, the Autumn of Fear, as it was later called. That is what held London under the spell of terror that Jack the Ripper could not be stopped.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 8. On this installment of the program, my friends, we have an absolute barn burner of an episode for you as we tread into some unfamiliar territory. Finally, venturing into the world of true crime, specifically the mysterious and infamous Jack the Ripper. However, while the topic is unfamiliar, the guest is quite familiar, as we welcome back to the program acclaimed investigative historian Gian Cassar, who returns to BOA Audio for an in-depth discussion on his latest book, Scarlet Autumn, The Crimes and Seasons of Jack the Ripper. Before I even preview the episode, I have got to put over this book. It is tremendous, my friends. Unlike so many other books on Jack the Ripper, Gian does not come into this with his own suspect and then tailor the story to fit his suspect and make you believe that he is correct. On the contrary, Gian turned to the historical record, looked back at the coroner's inquests of the Jack the Ripper victims, and provides a wealth of first-hand information that was reported by the police and witnesses at the very time of the Jack the Ripper slayings, providing some tremendous information and some real insights into what we actually know about the Jack the Ripper killings. Over the course of this comprehensive conversation, we are going to retrace the events of those Ripper slayings, looking specifically at the killer's canonical 5 victims. And we'll learn about the clues from the crimes that were uncovered by investigators of the era, but seem to have been forgotten as time has passed. You're going to hear about characters like Wynn Baxter. You're going to learn about tangential events that may be connected, like the Torso Killer, who was running amok at the same time as Jack the Ripper. And we're going to look at why some of the most famous Jack the Ripper suspects just do not fit the actual information that we know about what happened at the time. Altogether, this is an episode that will provide listeners with a far better understanding of what really happened during that terrifying autumn in London of 1888, as we strip away the mythology of the case and focus on the facts rather than the fiction surrounding the infamous Ripper killings with the incomparable Gian Cassar. For those folks who are unfamiliar with Gian Cassar, please allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Gian Cassar has achieved public acclaim for living a real X-Files life, and has been called the real-life Kolchak. Instead of pursuing the world of the unknown, unseen, mysterious, and macabre with the extemporanea of popular journalism, he has applied the keen surgical tools used in history, coining the term investigative historian. Yet his writings are not those of the academician. They are the result of a serious investigator, out to find the truth behind the world's unsolved mysteries and historical riddles. One of his books, They Flew Into Oblivion, inspired a congressional resolution. He has been the guest on hundreds of radio shows and the subject of over 30 documentaries on the History Channel, Discovery Channel, Travel Channel, NBC, Sci-Fi, Fox, TLC, BBC, National Geographic Explorer, and many others. He is a native of California and still resides there. His website is www.bermuda-triangle.org. Pretty simple, just do not forget the hyphen, bermuda-triangle.org. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on February 6th, 2014, Gian Kassar, talking about Scarlet Autumn, the crimes and seasons of Jack the Ripper, on BOA Audio, Season 8. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio, Season 8. Sit tight, my friends, because we are going to have an amazing conversation for you on this edition of the program. I am just completely blown away by our guest's book. You've heard him on the program before, of course, but this time around he's got something all new, and it is a tour de force, my friends. It is just tremendous stuff. Talking about the amazing Gian Kassar. He was on previously to talk about the Bermuda Triangle and his awesome book, They Flew Into Oblivion. Then a couple of years later, he came back to talk about recasting Bigfoot, which was this just mind-blowing book that he wrote looking at the Bigfoot phenomena. And just I was looking back today as I was marveling at the new book, and I remembered how blown away I was by recasting Bigfoot as well. So as you can tell, I'm going to be very excited about this program. And the new book is titled Scarlet Autumn, The Crimes and Seasons of Jack the Ripper. And I like to time these conversations and read the books as I get closer to talking to the guests, and sat down the last couple of days and could not put this book down. It's thrilling, folks. It really is a tour de force, as I said. It is a masterpiece. I'm completely blown away by this book. And I didn't know anything about the Jack the Ripper story before I sat down and started reading Scarlet Autumn. But after I was done with it, I could tell you all kinds of amazing just facts about this case that I'd never even known. Completely blew me away and had me just enraptured with this case and this story. So kudos to you, sir. Congrats on this. Welcome back to the program, Gian Kassar. I cannot wait to dig into Scarlet Autumn with you.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Now, it's been a couple of years since we had you on the show, Gian, so I guess let's catch people up to speed a little bit. Who is Gian Kassar? Tell us about your background and how you got really mixed up in looking at all these weird mysteries.
I don't know. By training, I'm a historian, which basically qualifies you for the unemployment line. And so I channeled it to my historical, research to my interest in mysteries, unexplained mysteries. And I've always fancied myself, like everybody else from my generation. We grew up in the 1970s with all these mysteries being shown us all the time, but they were never solved, from Bigfoot to Bermuda Triangle to UFOs to all this interest in the great villains of history who went uncaptured. And I just started investigating in the 1990s. So I guess 24 years now. And I put up the website in 1999 on the Bermuda Triangle when I saw all the old obsolete information that was up. And so that's what I originally became identified with, although that was only one aspect of what I researched. And so when someone, I forget what it was, I think maybe you might have put her on to me, a news reporter, called me the real-life Kolchak. I thought that was a compliment.
Absolutely.
So I mentioned that because, it's just whatever the mystery is that I'm interested in, I will investigate it, from something as carnival as Bigfoot to something as respectable, quote-unquote, as the true crime incidents like Jack the Ripper or the Cleveland Torso Killer or the Zodiac Killer or Amelia Earhart's disappearance. Investigative method applies to everything. It's just a question of being very careful and being very sincere in doing your research.
Yeah, I got to give you kudos in a big way, too. You could have sat on the Bermuda Triangle thing and just been the Bermuda Triangle guy for the rest of your life and probably done pretty well for yourself, but that you cast off into, like we said, the Bigfoot realm and then this Jack the Ripper stuff, and each
time you put something new out, it's amazing. So I can't thank you enough for the work that you do. There must be some sort of, like, seed, some sort of impetus that led you to the Ripper story. So what was it really that made you decide, you know, after recasting Bigfoot, this is the next direction I'm going to go. This is what I really want to look at next.
It's the mystery. It is the intentional mystery that he created. The victims were means to several ends. And the location in which he did it in the East End of London, which was far different back then than today, with all the streets crowded. They're very narrow streets even to this day, but all the buildings shoulder to shoulder, a dank alleyway here and there only occasionally. And the fact that he could do what he did on the streets, in a side yard or something, in pitch darkness, in the span of a few minutes before someone came along, was remarkable. This is not someone seizing the opportunity. This was someone who knew his ground and very carefully planned the mystery. And so that he played a game. He dangled a carrot before all of us, and I'm just one in a long line who decided to chase after it to try and discover who this guy really was.
Yeah, you hit on some of the things that really stood out that made me marvel at the case. The stealthiness of it all, the timing, the remarkable vision that must have been required to do this stuff, and you sort of intimated here that it seems like it was almost like an intentional puzzle that was created, which makes it even adds a whole another layer of of mystery to it.
Yeah, it covers his trail as well, and when we understand what his actual image was, which is far more interesting than the top-hatted gent with the cape of legend, and it is certainly far more interesting than, in the last 30 years, this rather undeserved image of the low-class Polish Jew that cropped up and, because of irony, it replaced the original image, which was, I said, you know, some Simon Pier or a doctor in a top hat. He would have stood out like a herring on a cupcake had he looked like that in the low-class East End. But in reality, he did stand out. He wore that uncouth deerstalker hat. Really, if you picture Sherlock Holmes, that's what Jack the Ripper looked like, because he wore a deerstalker hat, which is what Sherlock Holmes wore. He wore a dark cutaway suit. He was about 5'7", a dark, foreign-looking, dark hair, and he gave the appearance of being shabby genteel, and then he wore that ghastly deerstalker hat, which is a country gentleman's hat. It would not have been worn in the city. We don't realize that today, because we've seen all the Sherlock Holmes movies or whatever, and Conan Doyle never described Sherlock Holmes wearing that hat. It was purely a country hat. The equivalent today would be someone walking around the street wearing some Elmer Fudd hunting hat. Well, we'd notice him right away.
Yeah.
But the Ripper dressed dark in order to blend in with the nightlife of Whitechapel, but then he wore that hat indicating he was stalking his game. And when you realize that is his image, you realize that he went out of the way to stand out in one respect, then he's so adroitly transposed into the night, no one ever reported seeing such a person like that walking casually away or to a scene. He was seen only twice, and that was with the actual victim just before it must have happened.
Spooky stuff. The whole, I know it happened over 100 years ago, but I was still kind of looking over my shoulder after I'd read the book.
He is the quintessential stalker.
Yeah,
he must have had a very innocent-looking veneer, but he had a very diabolical intent.
Mm. Now, paint a picture here. Bring us, the listeners, back, because I love this part of the book. As I said, I learned so much, not just about the case, but history in general, really, as well. I guess take us back to 1888, that East End part of London. You really describe it vividly in the book, just sort of this hellhole, this armpit of the planet, this horrifying place. Paint that picture for folks. Give an idea the setting of all this, because that plays a critical part of it all, I think.
Yeah, it was the valve by which immigration came into London and therefore into Britain from the docks of the Thames nearby. It was also, paradoxically, the point to which workers, laborers throughout Britain focused into London, because this is where all the industry was going up. The new industrial revolution, it was not going to go up into the luxurious West End. It went into the East End. So here you have this paradox. You have what was a very grimy industrial part of the city. Brick everywhere. Everything was the new utilitarian brick. Victorians loved brick. They did not like the old varnished beams and plaster whitewash of Georgian London, they started bringing that down. So here you have this street after street of dark cobblestones, of brick, of coal-stained brick buildings, workhouses everywhere, chimneys belching out the new industrial waste, coal dust all over the buildings. Rain would then turn that into streaks, and it would look very mournful, like the buildings were crying. You have, at nighttime, the Thames fog mixed with all this ghastly coal dust, and the sky, which did turn it into this red, would probably be too stark a color, but it was a very dirty inferno look, like looking at the sunset after a volcano in the distance has erupted. That's the color of night and the smog that hung over Whitechapel. So here are these people walking along in all this coal-staining environment. They're poor. Tens and tens of thousands of foreigners who immigrated. 20,000 at least were thought to be prostitutes, but London did not like to mention that word. It took forever for the papers to finally broach what the victims were really like. They were unfortunates. That's what they were first called. They're fallen sparrows. They live, an unstable life. They didn't want to say prostitutes. The papers wanted to build this up into revealing all the social and economic problems in London, and if they had said that these were prostitutes, probably the majority of moral Victorians would not be as sympathetic, and certainly they wouldn't be as scared. The newspapers built this up into nobody is safe. And the later the director of the criminal investigation, which was Robert Anderson, said that your average housewife was never in danger. They knew what type of victims the Ripper picked on, and he picked on where he's going to find them, because this is where they were congregated in the East End. This was the center of vice for London. West End gents would go to certain higher-end houses in the East, but the Ripper's victims were the vagrants, were those who spent a few pennies a night to get a bed in a doss house, and by real definition, they probably were not prostitutes. They just did whatever they could to survive. And so it's not like they were organized into brothels or anything. These were the dregs. These were toothless hags, basically, winking over dirty smiles with coal stains on their face. These were nothing desirable. What he thought was expendable. These are the victims of a haughty mind who were very, I wouldn't say easy to get at, because he struck in such dangerous territory. But he got the vagrants who were out there, or, you know, working the night trade late on. And that was easy killings for him.
Yeah, that was one of the things I picked up from the book. It's remarkable. You say early in the whole piece, you say that the greatest hindrance to solving the crimes is their own popularity. And you point out throughout the book sort of how things have changed over time and the depiction of it all. And you hit the nail on the head with the prostitutes. I was surprised that... They weren't Julia Roberts here. They were,
they were
quite the opposite. Yeah.
Yeah, they were dregs. Now, this was someone who very consciously chose what he could get in the dark of night. They were certainly nothing that would be considered any stimulating quest. He never sexually abused them. The Ripper did not. He might have solicited them in order to get them off guard. But then he killed them like a humane butcher. He was quick, you know, to do his business. He would cut their throats quickly, and he would start the process of fetching what he wanted. And then he would just leave the bodies there.
It was, get the hell out of there as fast. It's amazing how he gets away so fast. And one of the other things that struck me, again, to sort of paint the picture of what we're dealing with in all this, is sort of, I guess you could call it almost the quaintness of the criminal investigation. I mean, or at least compared to what we have today. I was surprised that... we're jumping ahead in the story a bit here, but it's, I guess, only cognizant really to this point, that the Mary Kelly murder was the only one where they had any photos of the body. And I was just really surprised that, when they had the graffiti, the guy was going to go and get the camera. And I thought why, where the hell have they been this whole time with these cameras? Why aren't they taking pictures of, a lot more stuff? So I was surprised by that. This was really, quite a different way of life as far as getting to the bottom of these mysteries.
And there was some contention between the Met, Scotland Yard, which is the greater London police, and then City of London is itself. London grew from the City of London. That's just a square mile within London where all these the ancient edifices are, the Tower of London, the bank, and these places. But they have their own independent police force to this day. And because of that contention, one victim was killed in the City of London, and that's the one that afterward the Ripper wrote on the doorpost, "The Jews are not the men that will be blamed for nothing," something to that effect. And that's when City of London detectives wanted that, Detective Daniel Holtz actually wanted that photographed. And the Ripper, although he killed within City of London, he fled back into the Metropolitan District in Whitechapel. And so Sir Charles Warren came himself and said no, he didn't want a riot. And so he had it rubbed out before it was light enough to take a picture. And I think that's probably why Major Smith, who was in charge at the time of City of London Police, said, you know, we're bringing cameras down to Mary Kelly's murder no matter what. Get pictures of this. So that was the first time that pictures have ever been taken of a crime scene. You have to understand, with any serial killing, even today, the police are always at a disadvantage with the first or even second victims because they don't know this is going to turn into a serial killing.
Right.
They have to first assume this is
a random
something
one-off.
A little more prosaic, that the person knew their attacker. And back then, that was the standard mentality, although London actually was quite London police realized once they had a serial killer that he didn't know his victims. He just went around stalking the drabs of the East End. You have American police as late as the Torso killings in the 1930s in Cleveland who still went through the old routine that victims must have known their killer personally. And so London actually was a bit advanced for the time. They accepted this was just they believed it was a madman on the loose just trying to kill women for whatever motive he had.
Yeah, well, it was interesting in some of the accounts of the time. They call people lunatics. It's like a lot of people were labeled as lunatics. It was surprising how many people were shipped off to places or unsettling in a way.
Well, yeah, that was the mentality. I think a lot of people still have that evil and does not exist. That if someone does something like this, they have to be crazy. In reality, people can be evil, very sane, and very intelligent.
Hmm.
They're just very evil people. But back then, someone who went and did this had to be a madman. And I don't think, from what I've read about all the police and their disagreements with each other, I don't think they really saw how careful and methodical the Ripper really was. They preferred to picture this guy just on a bloodlust at night, when in fact he was extremely premeditative and very careful. Robert Anderson didn't even notice the clear inspiration the Ripper took from the newspaper, from the Star in particular, and started trying to use the killings to incite anti-Jewish riot in the East End.
Hmm.
He never picked up on that.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things going on in this whole story. It's amazing. I'm going to try and keep it kind of chronological. I hope that works for you. We'll sort of work our way through the story.
That's always best for my memory.
There you go. And I can assure you, folks, no matter how specific we get here in this in this conversation, we may touch on something called the Swanson Marginalia. But I can tell you, pick up this book, because afterwards you'll know a whole lot more about the Swanson Marginalia than we'll even be able to get into here on the show. So this is how serious I'm talking about this book. It's outstanding. I'm going to just hit on stuff that stood out to me about some specific instances, but I want you to obviously feel free to flesh this out and bring people up to speed on kind of what we're talking about. But you point out that I feel like this all kicked off, and obviously there's a big debate regarding the Tabram murder, which some presumed was the first Ripper murder, and nowadays it seems like it's not. It's debated, but it certainly kicked off the mania of it all. And you point out that the press saw it as a cash cow with many calves and used it to advance all these agendas, circling up about what we've already talked about, how bad things were for the folks in the East End. So I guess talk a little bit about that and sort of set the stage here for what's about to go down with the Ripper.
Yeah, Tabram's murder was in August, early August, I think the 7th, on a bank holiday. She was a fat, middle-aged, 39-year-old, quasi-prostitute who was out having drinks with a couple of the guardsmen, and she went off on her own route when her and her friend Pearlie Paul divided, and there is no record of where she went after that. And then finally, a few hours later, her body is found on the first floor landing of a crowded tenement house, and she had been brutally stabbed 39 times. Her hands were clenched in death, fingers clenched. So she had dug her hands into somebody. The bosom area of her dress had been ripped off. The landing, of course, then it was obviously a struggle. The back of her skull had been slightly bruised. And what excited the press and the police and everything was the fact that this happened in a crowded tenement on the first floor landing, which would be second floor in our parlance. So this was a landing going up to the second floor in this tenement house, and she died 12 feet away from the manager of the tenement house's flat. The door was closed, and they slept about 12 feet away on the other side, and no one heard anything. And it was the mystery, not just the macabre setting, not just a body found in a pool of blood and no trace from it. It was the setting that excited London. How could someone be murdered so violently, who was obviously conscious at the time in order to dig her hands into the assailant, and yet no one heard a thing. She was found only casually by one of the boarders walking downstairs to go to work around, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. So Martha Tabram's murder was finally written off as that of either a high rip gang, is what they were called. They blackmailed prostitutes, sharing some of their earnings with them. If not, they'd rip them to pieces. That's where they got their name. And so, but she was written off as something like that, that a gang must have gotten her.
Huh.
But then, at the end of August, it all changed. Now, that was in a George Yard in Whitechapel, about 3/4 of a mile away, if even that, in Bucks Row. This is when they find, in the early morning, the cop on the beat finds yet another body. That would be Polly Nichols. She's laying right on the cement, one arm outstretched, almost touching the gate. This is in the butcher yard area, industrial area of Whitechapel. Her throat is cut deeply, but there's only a small pool of blood by her left shoulder. And so this is now regarded universally as the Ripper's first killing. Her throat was cut. Martha Tabram's throat was not cut. But Polly Nichols' throat is cut. She was stopped dead right on the street, and there was no trace. And this was three cops patrolled Bucks Row back and forth around on their methodical 30-minute beats. And so the body was brought there, they thought, because there was no trace of blood, and dumped there, but then they realized there were no wagon tracks. None of all the bobbies heard anything, and this was early in the morning, 3:30, and so they would have heard wagons clunking along, horses trotting along. It was realized that she was killed right there. Her body is taken to the morgue only there when the detective raises her dress as he realized that her lower abdomen has been mutilated. None of the cops at the scene noticed that because there was such little blood. There was very little blood even on her underlinen, and yet there was only just a little puddle of blood by her left shoulder. Now, sadly, although the inquest accepted that this was a mystery, some have tried to explain this, that she was on a sidewalk that was so inclined it just all flowed down her back. That is not the case. Her clothes is described. Blood was only around her neck.
Well, that's
and shoulders.
Let me jump in here, because that's in my notes here. This is the question I have for you, because I couldn't quite wrap my mind around it. I kept sort of kept second-guessing myself, like maybe I'm confused by what went down here. But are you suggesting that the Ripper just somehow extracted the blood from her body?
That would have to be the only explanation, because of the lack of blood.
How would you do that?
That's what I don't know.
Okay.
I would think it would take three hands to do that. I explore that in the possibility that there was conspiracy, that there was more than one guy involved.
Mm.
But taking chronologically, as they looked at it, this is what faced them on a public street. And this was definitely the Ripper's doing. And the mutilations in her lower abdomen is what eventually caused the police to overlook the lack of blood because a week later, another prostitute was killed, and this in a backyard in dawn light. This was Annie Chapman, and she was just laid open with a knife. There was no pointless cuts. Her viscera was ripped open, and her uterus was taken with navel still attached. And that is what caused the inquest that was still sitting on Pauline Nichols' case. It caused the coroner, Wynne Baxter, to believe that she was, in fact, that the Ripper, not yet known as Jack the Ripper, the killer, wanted to do the same thing with Pauline Nichols, but had been interrupted by some men walking along going to work.
Huh.
And so that made them gloss over the fact that Pauline Nichols really did not even have sufficient blood at the scene, just a small puddle. The doctor described it as a wine glass to wine glass and a half full of blood by her shoulder, and that's all she had.
No one seemed to stop at the remarkable nature of how the blood was gone?
Well, they did at the time, yeah, at the inquest. But then, as I said, that seemed to have been so overshadowed by which was the most sensational killing that the Ripper ever did.
Right.
And that was the neat dissection of Annie Chapman.
Okay.
And then the removal of her uterus. And so Pauline Nichols was kind of forgotten.
Okay.
Both of them had their throats cut. But Pauline Nichols, really, her lower abdomen, the doctor described it in detail, was only mutilated. There was really no attempt to open her up. Her stays, her girdle, was still on. It had only been loosened, and the mutilations were only at the navel and below. Whereas in Annie Chapman's case, everything was ripped out of the way, and her whole torso was neatly sliced open. And so that dominated the entire investigation thereafter. That convinced Baxter Phillips, the police surgeon, that the killer was a mortician or a butcher, and Wynne Baxter believed he was a mortician or possibly even a doctor, and that gave us the image that's still with us today that Jack the Ripper was a very educated man and possibly a doctor because Annie Chapman's gutting was so professional. But there was she was in a pool of blood, so there was no attempt to take any blood.
Right.
And then, of course, the killing that then happened later. The next one would have been Liz Stride, which was at the end of September, September 30th, same day as the other one.
Right, that's the double event. Yeah.
And so in Liz Stride's case, in the darkness, she was her throat was cut, but nothing else happened. And apparently, they believe the Ripper was interrupted there. And then later, about an hour later, that's when Catherine Eddowes is butchered in the city of London, and it looked like a maniac went at her in Mitre Square. And it was then that the letter was received, and the person, at the time, they thought this could be a legitimate letter from the killer, and that's when he called himself Jack the Ripper.
Okay.
And that is what then held all of London for all of October and November, the Autumn of Fear, as it was later called. That is what held London under the spell of terror that Jack the Ripper could not be stopped. Because then in November, early November 9, he killed Mary Kelly in her little apartment. And he did the same thing there. This is where he completely dissected her, eviscerated her, and just it was a horrid mutilation. And those are the five accepted canonical murders, they're called, that Jack the Ripper definitely did. And he left the room, made sure the door was locked again so she'd be found in a locked room, and walked quietly away without leaving a trace, not a drop of blood on the floor, not a drop of blood on the doorknob, despite the gore that they found inside. So these were mystery murders, and those are the five that make up the canon of Jack the Ripper's victims to this day, although there were more that occurred at the time. For 2 years, London thought they were suffering under the effects of Jack the Ripper, but time has eliminated the other victims as the result of the London torso killer, who was thought to be somebody else, or an imitator. But with time, these five, Pauline Nichols, Annie Chapman, Liz Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Kelly, are considered his five victims.
So you discount the later cases like the McKenzie one and the, I think it was Casey or something like that, right?
I don't really discount the McKenzie one. It's hard to figure it out. Her murder was so, I glossed over the entire details. One thing all these murders are connected with, despite certain differences, they all occurred without they're all called mystery. The mystery was the ultimate purpose of the killer, to leave them here on the street or in bed without any sign of how he went about killing them and getting cleanly away. So that was the great mystery of Jack the Ripper, how he silently stalked his ground, struck, and then disappeared. That you find that in the Alice McKenzie murder as well, and that the killer killed her within 5-minute time between two bobbies walking back and forth in that alley where she was found, and that was the Ripper style. Even though her throat was not completely cut, it was stabbed, there was a 4-inch stab in it, her mutilations in her abdomen were very light. There was the imprint from a strong hand holding her, which was also characteristic of the Ripper. He left fingernail abrasions under their ear when he held their mouth so tight when he cut their throat. There were bruises on either side of their cheeks, matching his thumb and fingers as he held them that tight when cutting their throat. So those are all similar to a number of these cases. Whoever killed all these 12 prostitutes over the 2 years in Whitechapel did in fact have an incredibly strong grip, must have had very good night vision, knew the area very well, and came and went very quietly.
Now, I think it's
struck only prostitutes.
Right, right. Now, I think it's important to revisit what you mentioned here about how he earned his name, because it seems remarkable. It seems like interesting that it's pretty likely, and maybe you can explain this or clear it up for me if you think I'm wrong, but it seems pretty likely that the whole Jack the Ripper name was a creation of the press, because it turned out that one of the major purported letters from Jack the Ripper, they're almost certain, came from one of the newspapers themselves. So do you think that Jack the Ripper name really just was all part of the whole scheme that was cooked up by these newspaper folks to sort of become a part of the story, if you will?
You know, I think it was just a sensational name they gave. That makes the Ripper a little more mysterious. He never communicated openly. He didn't send letters bragging in a poor Cockney dialect using the American word boss, the Dear Boss letters they're called. He was somebody who communicated only by the gore of his crimes, by the careful staging of his crimes, by his attempt to incite riot from his crimes to cause upheaval. But I think Harry Dam and Fred Best were the ones who concocted Jack the Ripper. It ultimately was based on the idea of a high rip gang who went around blackmailing prostitutes. And so then this individual, you know, Jack was just the overall guy back then. So it was Jack the Ripper.
And it's funny because people generally believe that he was writing these letters to the newspapers. I think even today, though, if you stop somebody on this, you know,
before
I read the book, I think I always had the misconception that that happened, maybe because I entangled it with the Zodiac case so much.
Yeah, no, the Zodiac wrote his letters, but no, the Ripper, they thought at the time he did this during the autumn. They put up facsimiles of these on posts and in windows and everything, seeing if anybody could recognize the handwriting. So that's what really created him as Jack the Ripper, when people were walking along Whitechapel or all of London, not only seeing these handbills wanted, the Whitechapel murderers, as he was officially called, but then these facsimiles posted everywhere with the envelope, facsimile, and everything. And therein was the bloody signature, Jack the Ripper. So that's how he got his name. It fits perfectly what he did, but he is not someone who actually gave himself that name.
Right, right. And I got to ask you, clarify for me a little bit or enlighten me. How did you, this is a little bit off the beaten path, but I was amazed at how well you knew the background of these, of the victims. Because you really paint a picture here. You don't just drop their name and say this. You pretty much have a nice little thumbnail on their life story and how they ended up on the wrong end of the Ripper, if you will. So, I mean, tell me how you found that, how you did that kind of research and enlighten me a little bit on that.
Family and friends had to testify at the inquests and give a little background, and other Ripperologists have come over the decades and have found out a little bit more. There's obviously not a lot, since they were basically, you know, vagabonds. But no, the families had to come to the inquest, and the inquest proceedings were quoted verbatim in several of the major newspapers. And so that's how you find out where they lived, what Doss House, who they knew, what their reason was for spiraling into their lifestyle.
Okay. Well, talk a little bit about the inquest, because that was another part of the book that I thought was really interesting. It was like this twisted theater, especially, again, you paint the picture of some of these characters in the book. Wynn Baxter, when he shows up again later in the book, I think after, let me see, well, he shows up again a couple years later for one of the later cases they thought might have been the Ripper. You know, as I got deeper into the book, as I got to know this character so well, you know, he pops up again towards the end, and I was just like, oh, Wynn Baxter, what are you doing back in this story? You're such a troublemaker. But I found the whole thing really interesting. Was this like that's not something that happens nowadays. They don't have inquests like this in a public setting, do they? Was that
sort of, yes.
They do, okay.
Oh, yeah, you cannot have a private inquest, I think.
Weird.
But the newspapers simply today don't cover things as, especially if it's that lurid. But yeah, you can go and sit in an inquest just like you can go and sit in a court and listen to everybody arguing. Back then, though, this was phenomenal because of the mystery that was inherent in it. It was clearly, this was something new. The Ripper is considered the first serial killer. And so Wynn Baxter was from a newspaper family, and he had education in law, and he won the seat for coroner in this area. And thanks to him, thanks for all of his grandstanding, we have all this information. Either it would have been lost.
That's the point you
made. He made sure that these inquests were drug out for weeks. They were postponed and drug out for weeks. He conducted them like little mini trials. And had he not done that, we would not have 80% of the information we have today.
Wow.
Because that information was always implicitly promised to come in a trial when they had the suspect, but they never got him. So we never would have had the information. So if without Wynn Baxter, we would know nothing. Jack the Ripper would be a very antiseptic case. It would be all urban legend without any chance of actually coming across and documenting, in some cases, exact movements that night of the victims and the scene, and that the Ripper had a quirky type of voice and exactly what he looked like. All that is thanks to Wynn Baxter.
Why is that the case? Wasn't there any sort of, like, paperwork on all this stuff? Didn't they have files on the cases as it was unfolding, or was it a different sort of era where they just didn't write this kind of thing down?
They did not have... the inquest was responsible for some of that, but the trial is where all the details would have come out. Back then, police did not investigate like today. They didn't have the forensic technology. They would automatically, you know, look into the individual, the victim's life, and try and find some connection there. Thanks to Wynn Baxter, we have all the details of the crime scene. We even know how the evisceration occurred. It was up to the papers, he said, not them. It was up to the papers whether they wished to report this, but he made sure everything came out over weeks and weeks.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I was really blown away, because it was like this twisted theater that the press certainly seemed to enjoy as well. Let me see what else.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah. I guess talk a little bit about that, because it's hard, I guess, also. This is an all-encompassing thing. I mean, as you read the book, you really get brought back into this world, and I want to sort of convey that for the listeners, too. You know, I guess just talk about the furor that was going on at the time and how many papers there were and just how extent. I mean, because you have, like, pictures in the book from some of these papers, and they're these just, they look like comic books, kind of. They're really remarkable.
Oh, those are the Penny Illustrated.
Yeah.
And the Police Gazette. Oh, they had all the illustrators going. I don't know how many papers were in London back then, but there were a lot more. I concentrated mostly on the East London papers because they, of course, had a connection to the area, more than the Stately Times in the West or the Observer. But there was the East London Advertiser, East London Observer, the Echo, the Times, the Daily Telegraph is what I believe gave us the most details from the inquest. And so you can imagine a dull inquest room with a placard on the wall with a biblical quote and the juror sitting there and Wynn Baxter in all his Victorian glory. And then all these newsmen and all these artists sketching everything. They were sketching every witness coming up. They were sketching the jury. They were sketching the doctors, all the whole scene. So they animated it for us in a sense as well. But only the Police Gazette, out of all that I have seen, only the Police Gazette showed the Ripper once the way he had actually been described. That's the, there's only one illustration I know of in which Jack the Ripper is wielding a knife and wearing a deerstalker hat. Every other time, they just made him some low East End lout.
And I want to circle back into the canonical five here on another point I wanted to ask you about and highlight, I guess you could say, and that is on the night of the double event, two really interesting things that you point out in the book. In the first one, the Stride murder, the way that she was positioned so the blood ran like perfectly into a little gully of sorts, and it was just really amazingly planned, or luck. I presume it was planning, because it was just perfect timing, if you will. Talk a little bit about that and what you make of that, because this also had to be done in almost total darkness, if not total darkness, right?
Yeah, it was pitch dark when Morris Eagle, this was in the shadow, literally, of the Jewish Socialist Club. It was about 12:40 a.m. when she must have been attacked. Close to that, 12:35. So you're talking about pitch dark, 9-foot-wide entrance to the alleyway between the 3-story Jewish Socialist Club and the 2-story tailor shop. And so here the Ripper disappeared into this chasm of darkness with her, and that's where he cut her throat. It was not an area where couples hung out, so this, he had to have known it already and scouted the area for his own purpose. And it was so dark that at 12:40, when one of the members of the club, Morris Eagle, walked around from the front door and walked into the backyard through the gateway, he said it was so dark he could not swear that she was not there already. That is how pitch dark it was. And it's my contention that he's actually the one who interrupted the Ripper, because her throat had only been cut halfway through. The Ripper usually cut once across and then back again. But she was found perfectly positioned so that her neck was over the rut in the road, the little gutter. And from there, the blood could easily flow 18 feet away to the drain by the back door.
Mm.
So he had to have known the location, since couples did not frequent that area, as they put it. That is what, how good his eyesight was.
Yeah, it's almost supernatural in some ways, some of the stuff this guy was doing. And the other part of the double event that I thought was interesting is the second half of it. It seems, and you point out in the book, it seems like there was some kind of pressing need to commit the second murder. Something had to have precipitated that second event, second killing. And you know, it seems likely maybe this kidney situation has something to do with it, but I'm not sure. But it certainly seems like there was some kind of pressing timetable of sorts for something to be done that night.
Yeah, it's like not just a killing, but an organ had to be taken.
Mm.
It's hard to explain that. As I said, I believe with the first victim, that Polly Nichols, will consider her the first victim, just to make it easy.
Yeah.
That blood was taken. The mutilations in her lower abdomen can be a feint to draw a similarity to Tabram's death, to cover that there was another motive here, because Tabram was mutilated in her lower abdomen. We know a uterus with navel attached was taken for Manny Chapman. Liz Stride, nothing was taken. It seems very definite that the Ripper was interrupted. And then that very night, Catherine Eddowes, an hour later, in a very inconvenient spot, Mitre Square, is mutilated pretty quickly, opened up. Her uterus is not taken so cleanly, didn't get all of it, but what is taken neatly is the kidney. And this is now in the City of London, so the City of London doctor, Gordon Brown, thought there was anatomical knowledge displayed here as well, despite how sloppy the job was, and then the facial mutilations afterward, because the kidney was taken neatly. The uterus wasn't, but the kidney was taken very neatly, and it's usually overlooked, he said, because it's covered by a membrane. So he believed there was anatomical knowledge. And then in the case of Mary Kelly, which would be November 9, the heart was missing.
Right.
So there's, you know, we still today think that Jack the Ripper was after uteri, and there's really no evidence. The first victim that he even tried, the second, yes. The third, we don't know, but in the fourth, he might have taken the uterus as a feint to draw a connection to Win Baxter's very popular theory that he was a mad mortician going around for 20 pounds trying to collect these to give to some rich American. But he takes the kidney very neatly. And so what we have are different organs and then the heart finally being taken on November 9. So there really is no indication that the Ripper was after the uterus all the time.
Right. It was.
Nor is there any indication he was a sex killer.
At the risk of getting too speculative, what do you think the motivation is for this string of, stolen body parts and blood and whatnot?
Oh, that's what I don't like to talk about. Well, one has to speculate. You know, the Victorians were certainly into the black arts. It was a new big thing. They were picking up an awful lot of stuff from India. And the press even speculated this might be a mad Hindu, a mad Lascar, or a Malay on the loose. Was there some ulterior ritual that they had to be killed on certain days, or if not certain days, certain organs had to be fetched within a timely manner? For what reason? I'm not really an expert in what Victorians considered the dark arts back then.
Mm.
But certainly this conjures up pictures of, what would you use a kidney for, a heart, a uterus with navel attached, blood.
Yeah, it's weird.
And then taking them in these compromising positions. Mary Kelly shows he could have killed them indoors. He could have killed them in parks where he didn't have to worry, but he got them dead center right on the street.
So you're suggesting that maybe the location plays a role in the overall act?
Not necessarily the occult, like some have said, he's trying to draw a picture, connect the lines from each crime scene and come up with some emblem, some symbol. But it was the East End that was necessary. It was necessary to leave them in a circumstance that made everybody wonder how this could have possibly done. As you said, the newspapers speculated. They talked of him almost in the sense of the supernatural. That's how these killings occurred, within minutes of cops coming and going of people, and there's suddenly a body that's been eviscerated, and there's no noise, nothing, no clue. Well, there's lots of clues, but there's no clue that could ever be followed.
Right. I think it bears sort of repeating in a sense here, too, that two things really struck me about these murder scenes is the precise nature of this. He had to know, because these are like interlocking beats these cops are on. He really had to time this amazingly well. And people, I think, forget because we live in this modern time, but I presume, really, at the time these murders were committed, like 3 a.m. or something like that, there was almost no ambient noise.
No, not back then.
Mm.
Not back then at all. It would have been very quiet.
So, I mean, that's the layer to the mystery, because this guy is committing some really horrific crimes in this tiny little window and in pitch darkness as well, and not creating a sound. It's stunning.
Very narrow streets as well. No echoes, nothing.
Now, part of me was kind of wondering, and you didn't even get into this at all in the book, as far as I can tell, unless you sort of hinted at something like this, but I don't think so. Part of me was sort of wondering, is it possible that the Ripper was somehow had inside knowledge of some kind? Maybe he was somehow affiliated with the police or had some kind of official capacity that he'd know that he could stay a step ahead of what they were doing.
No, I don't think that would have helped, because they were completely bewildered. They weren't a step behind him at all. They were a step on every other side, despite the fact that Aberline, who was set back from an administrative position, was put in charge of the case, and he knew every inch of Whitechapel. He had worked it for 14 years, had all these contacts. They couldn't turn up anything. And one newspaper got so upset in the op-ed about how all the other newspapers are talking about how this is almost supernatural. And then this paper decried that and said that it's the prostitutes had all the knowledge of these police beats. They're used to knowing when, as soon as the Bobby on patrol, his footsteps fade away, they know how long it's going to be before he comes back around. Well, the evidence doesn't bear that out. Catherine Eddowes, who was killed in the City of London, didn't ply trade as a norm. Well, she didn't know the Watkins beat time in Mitre Square. It was only 15 minutes. Every 15 minutes he came through Mitre Square. How would Polly Nichols? That was not the usual area for prostitutes off Bucks Row. She wouldn't know the constable's, John Neal's, beat times. And if the Ripper's walking them to a place, how does he avoid always being seen by all these bobbies? No one ever saw a pair of people casually walking to these crime scenes. There is no evidence that any knowledge on the part of the prostitute would have helped the Ripper at all, because, you know, prostitutes didn't know when casual workers came along, coming and going from work. There's the case of Francis Coles, which one of the detectives considered to be the actual last Ripper killing. And she was found there in that tunnel in Swallows Gardens just seconds after one worker walked his horse through, and a few seconds, you know, a minute or so, when more workers passed by. And only casual footsteps were heard by the police constable when he was approaching the tunnel, so that must have been the killer walking casually away into the night. So how would the prostitute's knowledge help the Ripper to know police beats? He had to have known them himself.
Hmm.
He had to have gone to these areas. He had to have timed it. And he had to have known when he could strike and when he could get away. I don't even think Scotland Yard upper echelons knew all the police beats.
Yeah. It probably was very sort of personalized in a sense, where how would you know what Randy's routine was in Sector G or something like that? It would be difficult to pin down.
Yeah, it was only that it was generally the smaller beats, 15 minutes. Every 15 minutes they passed a given location. For the other ones, every 30 minutes. But then something might happen, of course, to delay the bobby or whatever.
Well, it makes you wonder then, we're getting into additional sort of speculative area here, but just thrilled to be able to talk to somebody about this case after reading the book. It makes you wonder then, if it stands to reason that he planned these really amazingly, almost perfectly, it's remarkable to take another look at the double event and see that he managed to have two perfect scenarios come together in one night. That's one of the more vexing parts of the whole story, I think.
Which would indicate he knew the locations already, and he could. But he certainly hurried at Mitre Square. He had no choice. Catherine Eddowes was seen with a man just before it must have happened by a couple of witnesses walking casually along outside Mitre Square. So he must have walked her in there at, what was it, about 1:35, and then at 1:44, 1:45, the cop, Watkins, comes walking through on his beat, and there's her body ripped open. He said it looks like a maniac went at her. And the watchman of Curly and Tongue's warehouse had the door open partially to the warehouse, and he was sweeping it out, and he never heard a thing. Watkins had to go up to him and get his police whistle so he could go get more help. And he hadn't heard a thing, and here's this, you know, so in 9-10 minutes after she was seen walking in there with a man, oh, there she is, mutilated in a pool of blood. He had to have known the location, because he escaped from a very narrow box-like square that had only three narrow entrances, and Watkins never heard, you know, shoes clacking away on the cobblestones in the night, so he never heard anybody running away. So what he did in 5-6 minutes.
And just to keep people up to speed here, in the 5-6 minutes, also remove the kidney.
Yes, remove the uterus, clumsily. Remove the kidney, so he had cut the bowel and put it by her side. So he had ripped, well, without being too graphic.
I'm just speaking to the.
He'd have to walk her in there, which would be casual. He couldn't rush her.
Right.
And then in the darkest corner where he did this, he had her lay down, and then from the way her hands were and her throat was cut and the abrasions under her left ear, we know he used his left hand, grabbed her mouth. She didn't even know what happened. He cut her throat and then ripped her clothes apart. He never cut clothes.
Mm.
Never.
Right.
He ripped them apart. The buttons went flying hither and thither, and then he eviscerated her, took two organs, mutilated her face, and rushed off without leaving a half a shoe print in blood, a drop of blood. It was just around her in a pool coming from her neck.
Yeah, I was marveling at the speed, really, to do all that. It's one thing to slice her throat and run away. It's another thing to perform rudimentary surgery in a tiny little, you know, obviously unauthorized, gruesome rudimentary surgery, but nonetheless, still, you know.
And in darkness.
Yeah, yeah, and in total darkness.
Basically, by Braille, he's feeling for the kidney, because you're not going to be able to see it.
My goodness.
So by Braille, he feels for it and takes it. And is gone without a sound, and no one sees anybody running. No one. There's no drop of blood. There's no trail. And only later in Whitechapel, a few blocks away, do they find a piece of her bloody apron thrown down. And then the cop on the beat there, knowing that there's all this turmoil blocks away, shines his light around looking for a trail of blood, and that's when he finds the chalk writing on the door jamb underneath it, over it.
Yeah.
Over the bloody apron, the Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing. And that was the new addition to the Ripper's crime spree right there. That is as explicit as it can get. There was no hint of anti-Semitism in Tabram's murder and Nichols' murder and Annie Chapman's murder. It's after her murder that Harry Dam, who was an American, we're responsible again, was an American journalist on the Star, came up with this whole lurid thing about a guy named Jack Pizer, this crazy Jew, he called him, with wild eyes, who was known as Leather Apron. He walked around in silent slippers at night, and he wielded a knife, and he's nuts. He's got this evil eye and this evil grin on his face the whole time. It was something out of Murders on the Rue Morgue, and this got the whole city upset that this crazy little Jewish slipper maker was doing it, and that's what almost caused riots in the East End. They had to bring out more bobbies to control the crowds on Hanbury Street, where Chapman was gutted, because when the guys got off work, the English congregated here, and they were shouting at the Jews for this. No Englishman could have possibly done this. And that's what really upset the whole East End into near riot state, and that's what shocked Sir Charles Warren. That's why he wanted no social riots, no race riots, nothing. And so here the next murder is Strides. That's at the end of the month. The double event is on September 30th. Chapman was killed on September 8th. So there was no killing until September 30th. And then Stride is murdered literally in the shadow of a Jewish socialist club. And Ed Oates, after she's killed, this writing is written over her bloody apron, an assignation against the Jews. Now, that is something so starkly different that it's clear the Ripper followed the news, and he realized that he could cause upheaval if he wanted to. And here he suddenly adds anti-Semitism to what otherwise was just before that a murder spree of low-class drabs.
Right. You make the point, too. It's interesting that a lot of the later suspects, or I guess the suspects of the time, but it sort of comes out later, were Jews. So a really, really religious undercurrent to all this, too, that people don't know about.
Yeah, it's odd, too, that I can't imagine. You read any book before mine, I don't think it's ever been picked up, even though Robin Odell thought it was an Hasidic Jewish butcher. He's the first one to really bring that back up. This, back in the time in 1888, 1889, when all the controversy and debate was going on, there were two extremes. Either this guy was a real low-class loser, or he was some high-end topper from the West End preying on the righteous hides of the poor. That's how the social issues of the time worked it all out. That kind of faded away and came back in the two respected post-war biographies of this event were Autumn of Terror, by Tom Cullen, American journalist, and then Robin Odell wrote Jack the Ripper in Fact and Fiction. And it's amazing and unintentional, but Tom Cullen took the view that this was a genteel person. He fingered Montague Druitt as being Jack the Ripper. Robin Odell fingered some low-class Polish Jewish butcher. So the two extremes remained with us and molded everything until today. That's still the extremes that most people have. Either it was a low-class Polish Jew, or it was your high-end, you know, a gentleman doctor in a top hat. And yet I don't see how anybody could look at the chronology of these murders and divorce them from all the newspaper reports, all the op-eds, all the complaining that was going on, all the manipulation, all the politics, and not realize how the Ripper clearly dovetailed on the riots that nearly came to be because of this, his image of leather apron, this little demented Jewish cobbler, and how the Ripper then tried to incite more riots against the Jews. Why would a Jew do that? How could they possibly think it was a low-class Jew, which some of the Robert Anderson believed that? He was head of CID. A couple of others, and then those who were really on the street level, didn't know anything. They, you know, Aberline said we never had a clue as to who this was. And City of London was sure that they had a butcher from Butcher's Row. Robert Segar was probably the real-life Sherlock Holmes. He was the City of London detective, and he just said it was that their suspect was a man on Butcher's Row. City Detective Harry Cox wrote an article in 1906 saying how he was watching this guy, and he said it was a Jewish neighborhood. So, by effect, we can say that the suspect for the City of London was a Jewish butcher. And I don't know how they could possibly think that, given the overall crime spree, how it developed.
Yeah. It's, yeah. Well, I guess maybe cultural bias. That might be the only...
I really don't think so. I don't think they saw it. I think they were that wooden in their response that they just, it got in their mind this was a maniac and that he could not be capable of subtler, ulterior motives.
Hmm. Well, stands to reason. I guess maybe you can enlighten me to more to this. Would it have to have been some kind of someone with medical training to pull off these organ thefts, or would someone with rudimentary butchery skills, you know, be able to pull it off also? Or it seems like a very narrow pool of people, but maybe I'm wrong, that would be able to do this sort of thing.
Well, a butcher, that was the debate. Some favored a butcher because he, you know, surgeons really aren't meant to hack you up. But a butcher would know how to do this and cut the throat like that. He had anatomical knowledge. That was not debated. But the level of surgical skill was. Baxter Phillips, who was the police surgeon, said in the Annie Chapman case there was surgical skill. It was neatly done. There was no pointless cuts at all. And that then contrasts with the other murders in which certain mutilations were attempted.
Mm.
Whether there's a cover or not. I would say he had a certain level of surgical skill. When Baxter believed he was a mad mortician, who they obviously know how to dissect. The papers wondered if it wasn't a mad vivisectionist on the loose who was trying to prove one of Darwin's theories. And so he chose, you know, lower forms of life to dissect. I would say that the Ripper, being described as not a laborer by one of the men who saw one of the victims with this unidentified man, that he probably did have some kind of, he was not a doctor, I don't think, but he had medical knowledge.
Yeah, that was kind of the thought I had, too. This was sort of a time when people were very sort of amateur. you know, he could be a clerk, but he also could be sort of an amateur person with a hobby of human body interest that kind of went off his rocker. Is that possible, you think?
Well, it was a time in which being self-taught and being, you know, having new ideas was appreciated.
Hmm.
But I think he might have, I think, you know, you have to practice makes perfect even for something as ghoulish as this. So he had, I think he had actual medical training of some level, some mortician level. I think he knew things beyond even what a doctor knew. Because doctors don't disarticulate bones or anything.
Right.
But I don't know how well he knew it. Baxter Phillips thought that the Ripper tried to remove Mary Kelly's head, but couldn't do it. And so a medical doctor would really not even know how to do that. But a mortician or a butcher would know how to do that. So that kind of negates the Ripper being a butcher if he tried and couldn't do it. So maybe he was just a mortician. Maybe he did have a certain level of medical knowledge. But I don't think he was just some low bum that went crazy to get revenge on women. And that's what some of the detectives believed.
Hmm.
No, it's a simple explanation.
It certainly seems like there was an agenda at work. I'm surprised they didn't really pick up on that, or maybe, I guess they didn't, right? Because we would know now, later, if it had been in discussion amongst the, you know, the detectives. Hey, look at all this, how it keeps happening. He keeps taking an organ or something.
No, they believe he was just a demented lowlife who was a woman hater and wreaking revenge on women for having been wronged. That's Tom Cullen was the first to actually notice an underlying social pattern in 1965 when he came out with his book. He's considered the grandfather of ripperologists. And he even noted that he didn't bring up the anti-Jewish change that occurred with the double event. But he did notice that November 9 was the day of Mary Kelly's butchery, and that would be the day of the Lord Mayor's parade.
Hmm.
And so he'd said if, you know, he wanted to cause upheaval in the government, he would strike on that day, and which is what he did back then. He struck on the 9th, and then the women started, the news went all over London just by word of mouth, and it caused a riot in the Lord Mayor's parade that this butcher could not be stopped. So there you have absolutely no inkling of an ulterior motive outside of taking organs in the first three victims. Then you have anti-Semitism, attempted riots of anti-Semitism in the double event. And then when that failed, you have the Ripper striking on the 9th trying to cause upheaval of the local government during the Lord Mayor's parade, which is a very solemn event in the City of London.
So there was also maybe a second agenda is kind of what you're suggesting. That
I think he evolved it. When he saw he could cause upheaval, he tried.
Hmm.
And it covered more and more what he was going to do anyway. He took a heart. There's no need to do that just to cause political upheaval. He immediately was, you know, he took the uterus from Annie Chapman. That was before any attempt at anti-Semitism or political upheaval.
Right.
His original motive appears to be mystery murders. And that seems to cover his other ulterior motive of taking either blood or certain organs from the victims.
Now, what do you mean? His goal was to kill in a way that would baffle people?
Mm-hmm. As part of his own cover. And I think to keep them from noticing what, you know, that he was taking organs for some ulterior motive. I think he had some reason. He wasn't just a madman taking souvenirs. He was too cautious. And then when he saw he could create upheaval, he used that as a cover.
Hmm.
And so he tried to bring in race and politics. But he still took an organ. And he just didn't butcher and kill them. He was still fetching something that he wanted.
Right. Almost like he was thinking, if I can get them all wrapped up in this
Right, they
debate.
Won't even know where I'm going with this.
Right.
Because remember, if he only did kill the five, the canonical five, stopping with Mary Kelly on November 9, 1888, he stopped suddenly. He took a heart, and that was the crescendo. Nothing else happened. And he fades away. The other murders we can attribute to copycats, or whatever, if you wish. But if the consensus of most ripperologists are that he just killed those five, we have to try and explain why he suddenly stopped after his most gruesome butchery.
Do you remember what we were? Do you remember
the project? At the Luton Palace, we were talking about a rock musical based on the life of Jack the Ripper.
Yeah,
right.
Saucy Jack.
Saucy Jack. Saucy now
Jack.
Is the time to do
you're
that.
You're a naughty one, Saucy Jack. You're a haughty one, Saucy Jack.
Right.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
You're a naughty one, Saucy Jack. You're a haughty one, Saucy Jack. When the street lamps gaslight flickers and fails, then you see the last light glinting off the entrails. Oh, naughty, 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 you're a sneaky one, a Saucy Jack. You're a cheeky one, Saucy Jack.